Hello, listeners, and welcome back to the next episode of In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. As always, I'm your host, Paul Townsend, and I want to again thank everyone who has reached out, left feedback, and made suggestions and requests. And speaking of requests, we're going to honor one today. A listener reached out for my opinion in the recent Derek Chauvin trial. Chauvin, as everyone in America with a pulse knows, was the police officer recently convicted of both the murder and manslaughter of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota. This particular listener was interested in the difference between manslaughter and murder, when they're charged together and when they're charged separately. And since this is a podcast show really for listeners, and I try to focus my show on what people, especially those who don't have a law degree, are interested in hearing about, we're going to do just that today. I've covered several cases already which deal with defendants who've been charged with murder. I've gone through what murder is on George Zimmerman, Jack Kevorkian, Phil Spector, and Chanel Lewis episodes. But today, we've really not covered a case which dealt solely with manslaughter and really focused on what manslaughter is. So that's what we're going to do today. In addition to discussing the elements and layman's definition of manslaughter, we'll also spend a bit of time discussing consecutive versus concurrent sentencing and double jeopardy, as those tend to be concepts which a lot of people I know don't really fully comprehend. These topics will all come into play from a situation which, despite occurring over a century ago, has had not only lasting implications in other areas of law, but has left an indelible mark on New York City itself. On March 25th, 1911, the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors of the Ash Building, located a couple blocks off Washington Square in downtown New York City, were home to the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. At just after 4:45 p.m. on that day, which was the end of the workday, somebody on the 8th floor screamed, "Fire!" Panicking, the employees of the Triangle Shirtwaist Company, mostly immigrants, mostly teenage girls, ran down the single fire escape. Moments after they started down, the fire escape collapsed due to the weight of having so many people on it. Seconds later, the elevator stopped functioning. Desperate, the employees braved the flames to push to the building's main staircase, only to find the door had been locked from the outside. While some employees on the 10th floor were rescued by the quick actions of neighbors in other buildings who found ladders to make a bridge over the divide, 146 people lost their lives between the blaze and those who jumped from the 8th and 9th story windows to avoid burning. An enraged public demanded answers and accountability. The two owners of the Triangle Shirtwaist Company were arrested and charged with manslaughter. This is the State of New York versus Max Blank and Isaac Harris. Max Blank and Isaac Harris had been dubbed the Shirtwaist Kings of New York. They operated the largest clothing company in the business at the time. A shirtwaist, for those of you unfamiliar with the clothing terminology of the early 20th century, is a woman's blouse. From the early 19th century to the mid-20th century, the term waist was common in the United States for the bodice of a dress or for a blouse or women's shirt. So Blank and Harris operated a pretty substantial company which made mid-quality, relatively affordable women's shirts. The factory which produced the shirts occupied the top three floors of the Ash Building in downtown New York. Harris and Blank met in their 20s. Both were Jewish immigrants who were born in Russia and came to America during the 1890s. Harris had initially been a skilled tailor, was a sweatshop worker himself. Blank was more of an entrepreneur, setting up a garment contracting business for himself in 1895. Blank married a woman whose cousin married Harris, which is how the two met in the late 1890s. Harris and Blank were respected businessmen in the fashion and clothing industry in the early 1900s, though outside of the clothing industry, few people probably would have recognized their names or faces. Harris knew the details of garment production, and Blank was a natural salesman. But people familiar with the Triangle's shirtwaist viewed them as hard workers who had grown a very, very large company, honestly. They'd never been in any real trouble with the law and had no abnormal business disputes. I say abnormal business disputes because during this time period, virtually every industry in New York had some sort of dispute between labor and management, leading to strikes or attempted shutdowns, and the garment industry was no exception. Still, Harris and Blank had a reputation in general for fair dealing. In 1902, Harris and Blank moved into the ninth floor of the Ash Building in Lower Manhattan. In 1906, they expanded to the eighth floor, and then subsequently the 10th, which was also used for their administrative offices. Harris and Blank took Triangle's success and reinvested in the company, opening factories in New Jersey and Pennsylvania as well. They were driven to work in chauffeured cars and moved from cramped Lower East Side tenements into Upper West Side brownstones. By 1908, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory was producing more than 1,000 shirts a day and was the largest manufacturer of blouses in New York City, in a field with over 11,000 other textile manufacturing competitors. One thing that separated the Triangle Shirtwaist Company from virtually every other garment manufacturing producer at the time was that the company centralized all operations in one location. Most companies who employed sweatshops would be spread out over many small locations. Owners hoped this would prevent the workers from organizing and unionizing. But in the Ash Building, all the workers were together. This did lead to one strike in 1909, which caused significant turmoil, but in general, the company enjoyed increased efficiency by having the owners, managers, and workers all located in the same place. That is, until March 25th, 1911. Shortly after 4:45 p.m. on that date, a fire ignited on the eighth floor. Seeing the flames, a woman named Dina Lifshitz called up to Harris and Blank on the 10th floor and told them that a fire had started and that they could not get it put out. Lifshitz tried to call the 9th floor, but no one answered the phone. On the 10th floor, the two owners, as well as 67 of the other 68 employees on the floor, managed to escape by climbing to neighboring rooftops from the top of the Ash Building. A professor teaching a class at New York University Law School on the floor above the ash roof in a nearby building saw the flames out the window. He and his students saw people congregating on the rooftop of the Ash Building. They found ladders left by painters and managed to create a pass, allowing all but one to survive. The workers on the eighth floor rushed to escape down the stairs and the elevator before the flames spread too far. Many were able to make it out before the fire put the elevator out of operation. Now, there were two staircases at the Ash Building and one elevator. With the elevator no longer working, the workers desperately fled to the stairs. The two staircases consisted of the fire escape and the main stairwell. Many were able to make it out the fire escape before it collapsed, leaving the main staircase as the only means of exit for everyone left in the building. On the 9th floor, workers only became aware of the fire when smoke started to fill in the open room they were all in. 145 employees were on the 9th floor when the fire broke out. Nearly all of them would die. Very few were able to get down the fire escape before it actually collapsed. The vast majority of them were forced to attempt to use the main staircase. But those that rushed the door to try and gain entry to the stairwell were shocked and horrified to discover that the door had been locked from the outside. With no elevator and no fire escape, they were literally trapped on the 9th floor with the flames creeping toward them. Many jumped out the window rather than burn, but none survived the fall. Others were paralyzed with fear and were found later as charred remains. The fire was put under control in less than 18 minutes, and all but extinguished 10 minutes after that, but the damage had been done. All told, 146 people were killed either from the fire or from the fall. At a time when sweatshop conditions were already the subject of much public scrutiny in New York City, an outraged community started demanding answers. People wanted accountability for this tremendous loss of life. The fire marshal who investigated, William Beers, determined that the fire started when a lit match was thrown into a wastebasket near oil cans or into cloth clippings on the eighth floor. Beers found many cigarette butts nearby, despite a strict no-smoking policy, and posted signs prohibiting the practice. Many employees who survived corroborated that smoking was commonplace on the eighth floor. Fire Chief Edward Croker added to Beers' report that to gain entry to the ninth floor after the fire had been put out, they had to chop through the door because it had been locked. Upon learning that the staircase door had been locked, the public went into a frenzy. Blame first went to the New York City Buildings Department. Editorials claimed that there had been inadequate inspections of the factory. As a result, new policies were enacted, which set codes for fire escapes and more stringent standards for buildings. Many code violations, which had previously been grandfathered in, were now required to be remediated, meaning that a building which passed inspections at the time, because when it was built, it was acceptable, now those buildings would be required to make updates as codes changed and they fell out of compliance. Ultimately, the blame settled on Harris and Blank. 2 weeks after the fire, they were arrested and indicted on charges of manslaughter. This is a good time to discuss the difference between murder and manslaughter, where they overlap and where they differ. In New York State, there are varying degrees of murder and manslaughter, with more serious offenses receiving harsher penalties. Typically, the gravity of the offense has to do with the actor's intentions at the time. First, let's just do a brief recap on murder. In general, most people view murder as the intentional killing of another person. That intention is a key element. There are subsets of murder, like felony murder, which don't require a specific intent to kill, but it still requires the intention to commit a felony, and a death is caused during the commission of that felony. But in general, murder is charged when one person sets out to kill another person and causes their death. Manslaughter is different than murder because manslaughter does not have that specific intent to kill requirement. In New York, there are two common ways that manslaughter can get charged, and then there's one less common but still relevant for our case here that we'll discuss. First, a person can be charged with manslaughter when they intend to cause serious harm to another person, but not to kill them, and yet the person dies anyway. For example, let's say that Adam and Steve don't like each other. They live near to each other, but have never gotten along. One night, Adam and Steve both find themselves at the local bar, enjoying the results of Highland distillation. Neither can resist trading barbs, words are exchanged. This leads to Adam calling Steve to meet him outside the bar, and Steve obliges. Adam and Steve get into a fist fight. Both are swinging wildly due to their levels of intoxication. Adam manages to hit Steve on the side of the head. Steve loses his balance, stumbles backwards. He trips on the sidewalk, falls to the ground, and his head lands on a pile of bricks on the sidewalk. Steve dies from the impact of his head on the bricks. Based on the circumstances, it would be hard to convince anyone that Adam was actually trying to kill Steve. They were just fighting in the street. But now Steve is dead, and Adam is certainly to blame. Adam is going to be charged with manslaughter because he intended to cause serious harm, but ended up causing a death. And when we say serious harm, we mean more than a bruise or a little cut. New York law defines serious physical injury as an injury which causes disfigurement or impairment of health or impairment of a bodily function. Serious physical injury is separated from merely physical injury in New York, which is simply characterized as causing impairment or a physical condition of substantial pain. That would be a cut or a bruise. In practice, if you hospitalize somebody, if you knock them unconscious, if you break a bone, that's going to be considered serious physical injury. Remember that in this scenario, the defendant is still acting with some intention, but that intention is to harm, not to kill. The other common way that a person can be charged with manslaughter requires no direct to cause harm whatsoever. This occurs when a person's actions are so reckless that the defendant is disregarding a substantial risk that death could occur and engages in the behavior anyway. Here is a New York example to illustrate this point. There was a building owner who was cited several times for the condition of a building which was eroding terribly. The citations expressed concerns that certain exterior parts of the building had become so damaged over time through neglect that it was causing a danger that large chunks may fall and hit somebody walking below on the sidewalk. The owner did nothing. Sure enough, a large chunk fell from 11 stories and hit a pedestrian, causing her death. The owner of the building was charged with reckless manslaughter. The owner never intended to kill the pedestrian, but he was aware of the risks through the violations he received, and he persisted in not fixing the situation, knowing that there could be a substantial risk of death. Now let's discuss the less common manslaughter charge. It's called misdemeanor manslaughter, and it's a lower equivalent to felony murder. So if the person is in the process of committing a felony and causes another person's death, it's felony murder. Under basically the same theory, if a person is committing a misdemeanor and causes another person's death, then it constitutes misdemeanor manslaughter. Again, it's not common because most people don't die through the commission of a misdemeanor. But Harris and Blank were charged both with the reckless disregard manslaughter as well as misdemeanor manslaughter. The misdemeanor in this case that the prosecutor alleged they were committing was a business law violation which prohibited locking employees into a workspace. The two owners were surprised, finding themselves on the business end of a criminal prosecution, when they felt that they themselves were the victims. Their business had literally just gone up in flames. They hired Max Stewart as their defense attorney. It's exceptionally rare in today's legal landscape for co-defendants to have the same trial lawyer. Most judges will not allow it, even if the parties themselves want it. This is done to protect each individual defendant's rights. If halfway through the trial, it becomes evident to Blank that the only way he could save himself is to throw Harris under the bus, sharing the same attorney would make that relatively impossible to do. But this was 1911, and it was allowed. Stewart was a very prominent defense attorney at the time, and Harris and Blank both wanted him. 146 people died in the fire on March 25th, 1911. But Harris and Blank were not charged with 146 counts of manslaughter. They were charged with two. One count of reckless manslaughter and one count of misdemeanor manslaughter each. Although it may not seem like it, this actually makes a lot of sense. It's because of potential punishments. In the criminal justice system, when a person is convicted of multiple crimes and incarceration is going to be imposed, the judge has to determine whether to sentence a consecutive or a concurrent period of prison. In a nutshell, concurrent sentences means each imposed sentence is running at the same time. So if John robs a bank and is convicted both of the robbery and grand larceny charges, he'll be sentenced on both charges. Let's say he gets 10 years for bank robbery and 5 years for the larceny. But the judge runs them concurrent. That means that 5 years in, he will have served the full term for the larceny and at the same time be halfway done with the robbery sentence. Consecutive sentencing, on the other hand, means that one term does not begin until another one ends. If John robbed a bank and then stole a car to get away and was sentenced to 10 years for the robbery and then 5 years for the auto theft, and they were run consecutively, then once the 10-year sentence for the robbery is done, the following day would be the first day of the 5-year sentence for the auto theft. So clearly, how sentencing is arranged makes a really big deal. But there are some rules. For example, in New York, if multiple charges stem from the same set of facts or from a single act or omission, then the sentences must run concurrently. So if we apply that principle to the Triangle Shirtwaist trial, all 146 people died as a result of the same act or omission. And so technically, it does not matter if Harrison Blank are convicted of one or 146 counts of manslaughter. They would be getting the same amount of time on their sentence as everything would run concurrently. And now, the prosecutor does not need to prove 146 individual deaths occurred through testimony and evidence, which would simply be a long and tedious process, which would get him nothing new in the end. So a woman named Margaret Schwartz was deemed the representative decedent for the entire group. The prosecutor assigned to the case was Assistant District Attorney Charles Bostwick. During the trial, he and Stewart argued over one basic yet key issue, the locked door. Bostwick argued that by locking the door to the staircase, the owners of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory were consciously disregarding a substantial risk of death in the event that a fire broke out. Bostwick argued that Harris and Blank were directly responsible for locking the door, as they thought it would be a preventative measure to prevent inventory theft by employees. The door had been locked with their knowledge and by their direction, and thus they were responsible for the deaths caused by the employees' inability to escape. Stewart, on the other hand, argued that Blank and Harris did not know whether the door was locked and offered some evidence that the door may not even have been locked at all. Whether the door was locked, and if so, who knew it was locked, became the focus of the entire trial. If you've listened to past episodes of this show, you've heard me say that when a defendant is put on trial, he is tried for the particular acts which a prosecutor is alleging were criminal. He is not on trial for things he has done in the past, and a prosecutor is prohibited from making the argument that a defendant has done the same thing in the past, so it's more likely that he did it now. When discussing Michael Jackson, we discussed how prosecutors can sometimes get around this rule by offering the evidence of past actions for a legally permissible reason, rather than just to show that someone has a tendency to commit crimes. With Jackson, it was a discussion on how a particular modus operandi lends credibility to witness testimony. But what about the concept of a habit? And not just habits of criminal behavior, I'm talking about general menial things that people do over and over again. They have no implication that someone is morally or ethically suspect. If those habits are relevant, under New York law, they can be admitted for the purpose of showing that a person has a habit of doing something. That does not implicate the prohibition against bad character evidence. A person's habit or an organization's routine practice may be admitted to prove that on a particular occasion, the person or organization acted in accordance with the habit or routine practice. The court may admit this evidence regardless of whether it is corroborated or whether there is an eyewitness to the action. That is the rule in New York. As you can imagine, habit played a big role in the Harrison Blank trial. Bostwick argued that the Triangle Shirtwaist Company, as an organization, had a habit of locking the door to the ninth floor, and that this was the result of the habitual instructions of the owners to do so. There were 155 witnesses who testified in the trial. Over 100 of them were called by the prosecution. Bostwick laid out his narrative. His witnesses testified that the doors were routinely locked. Some of the managers testified that the owners told them to do so in order to prevent theft, though in actuality, a minuscule amount of theft had ever occurred at the company. In addition to the owner's habit of having the door locked, they were on notice of the dangers a fire could cause, as they had had 5 recent fires. No fatalities had occurred during them, but they had incurred significant monetary loss because they had difficulty putting them out in time. This, Bostwick argued, put the owners on notice that locking the door could have disastrous, deadly consequences. Bostwick claimed that the evidence showed that they did so because 9 years earlier, they had caught 6 employees stealing a grand total of less than 15 shirts. But Bostwick did not have a witness who could testify that Harris or Blank had instructed the door to be locked on March 25, 1911. This was an omission that Stuart seized on. Stuart's argument was equally simple. He first argued that the door was not locked, and that the people who lost their lives on the ninth floor did so because the fire had prevented people from being able to use the stairs, not because they could not enter the stairwell. He produced employee witnesses who unconvincingly testified that they recalled seeing the door open that day. But he also questioned prosecution witnesses who had said the same thing. Bostwick had called a woman named May Levantine. She was working at the factory on March 25, 1911. After the fire, she had refused to speak to Stuart, but had a recorded conversation with Bostwick. While on the stand, she testified that she had gone through the stairwell door and seen the flames on the stairs, so she went back in and closed the door behind her. She became a focus of the defense summation. To counter this idea of habit, Stuart also called multiple vendors and delivery men who frequented the business. They testified that in making deliveries to the ninth floor, they had never seen the door locked. He questioned the managers who testified about whether they had been instructed to lock the door, and all of them said no, for that particular occasion, they had not been instructed. But Stuart was aware that the fire marshal's testimony would be very powerful, and he very clearly stated that the door was locked when he and his men were able to get to the ninth floor. So Stuart had a secondary argument. He always maintained that the door wasn't locked, but he claimed even if it was, there was no evidence that Harrison Blank knew about it. And if they didn't know that the door was locked, they could not be held criminally liable for it. In making these arguments, Stuart was defending against both theories of manslaughter at the same time. While Bostwick called many of the factory workers who lost friends and family members of the deceased, Stuart was able to artfully show that these people all blamed Harrison Blank and were testifying in retaliation. He claimed that they were biased, and many admitted to having filed civil suits or had plans for civil suits against the owners, suits which would be aided by a determination of criminal liability. The trial had started on December 4th, 1911. Between jury selection, 155 total witnesses, and the Christmas holiday, the jury went into deliberations on December 27th. Assuming nothing took place on Monday, the December 25th of that year, that means there were 17 days of actual trial time, including the 27th. What this means is that the trial averaged between 9 and 10 witnesses per day, an unheard-of rate for testimony. The jury had the case for less than 2 hours before reaching a unanimous verdict of not guilty on both charges of manslaughter and the locked door misdemeanor. So what went wrong for Bostwick here? Why was it so easy for the jury to determine that Harrison Blank should not be criminally liable for the deaths that occurred in the fire? In interviews later on, several of the jurors expressed what they thought the most important issue in the case was. They all felt from the outset that, despite Bostwick being allowed to argue habit about locking the doors, and testimony from some of the employees about how they knew that the doors were always locked, there was simply no evidence that Bostwick could point to which showed that Harris or Blank knew the doors were locked on March 25th, 1911. They were not on trial for being in the habit of locking the door in the past. They were on trial for locking the door on that particular day, and the jury did not believe it had been established beyond a reasonable doubt that they had any idea what the condition of the door was. Because of that, they felt they could find the men not guilty. Less than 3 months after the acquittal, the New York County District Attorney moved for a new trial and attempted to prosecute Harris and Blank for the manslaughter of a different person who had died in the fire, a man named Jake Klein. This brings up a very interesting legal question. If it's a new victim, then the charges are new, because the elements have technically changed. No longer does Bostwick have to prove that the defendants caused the death of Margaret Schwartz. Now the elements include that they caused the death of Jake Klein. Can a prosecutor do this? The answer is no, because of the legal concept of double jeopardy. Under our system, Harrison Blank had not only been put on trial for the manslaughter of Margaret Schwartz, but for the conduct which comprised the elements of those charges. Boswick wanted to charge the same substantive charge, manslaughter, just with a different victim. But Judge Samuel Seabury decided that that violated double jeopardy because the defendant's culpability in the deaths resulting from the fire had already been determined by the jury. Here's a good example to explain double jeopardy. In 1973, there was a case in Ohio of a man named Nathaniel Brown who stole a car from a Cleveland parking lot. He was arrested 9 days later while driving the car. He was charged with joyriding, which is defined as taking or operating a car without the owner's consent. He was convicted of joyriding and received a relatively low sentence. The government decided then to go back and charge him with the car theft itself. But because to prove joyriding, a prosecutor would not have had to prove anything outside of what would have been required to prove auto theft, the Supreme Court determined that this violated double jeopardy. I find that this confuses people because in Hollywood, they butcher this concept over and over and over again. Movies like Fracture, and actually the movie Double Jeopardy itself, misstate the legal principles and confuse the public. Please do not cite to any movie in making an argument on whether double jeopardy, or really almost any other legal concept, applies. Unless, of course, you get the concept from My Cousin Vinny. That one is pretty accurate. In order for double jeopardy to attach, a prosecutor has to place a defendant in jeopardy. That doesn't occur when a person is simply charged with a crime. A person can be charged, have those charges dropped, and then be recharged again later with the same charges. Jeopardy attaches when a jury has been selected and sworn in, as now the defendant is considered to be in real danger of losing liberty. As a finer point, a defendant can be retried in cases of a mistrial or some other administrative things that lead to a jury trial not ending in a guilty or acquittal verdict. But in general, if a jury is sworn in and the case results in a verdict, the government cannot go back and try the case over again. Judge Seabury very correctly applied that principle here. It certainly would have been improper to allow the district attorney to keep trying Harrison Blank over and over again until they managed to finally get a conviction. It's possible that they would have tried to go through all 146 victims, pushing for a trial on each one until they were finally able to convince a jury to convict. That is simply not how the criminal justice system works. In summation, I believe this was a winnable case for both Charles Boswick and Max Stewart. Both of the attorneys had good, simple narratives, but Boswick made the mistake of over-trying the case. He put on over 100 witnesses. That was likely his fatal flaw. There were so many people who testified, so many accounts, so many stories that it presented a host of opportunities for Stewart to exploit inconsistencies. I understand Bostwick's position. He had a number of grieving family members, friends, and employees who lost loved ones who were dying to testify against Harrison Blank, but streamlining the trial would have been in his best interests. For example, Boswick did not need to call May Levantine. By doing so, he stirred up some doubt as to the condition of the door. Boswick, again, should have just streamlined his case, focused on the horror and the atrocity. More of an emphasis should have been made during the summation on the fire marshal's report that the door was locked. Boswick's discussion of this key point was muddled in the middle of his summation. It was lost in the shuffle when it should have been the main focus. It should have been what he led with. It should have been what he ended with. In connection with the fire marshal's report, Boswick needed to really hammer home the concept of habit and how locking the door was a commonplace occurrence and link that to the knowledge of what could happen as a result of the door being locked. Emphasis needed to be placed on the previous fires, and the testimony of the former managers and employees should have been brought up over and over again in the summation to really demonstrate the concept of Harrison Blank's knowledge and really intention that the door be locked and what the consequences of that were. Not doing that to the degree necessary is what allowed the jury to sit back and come to the conclusion that the knowledge just wasn't there, leading to the acquittal. For his part, Stewart earned his reputation as an excellent defense attorney. He kept his narrative simple also and made sure his defense addressed all the charges. He certainly did not need to call 50 or more witnesses of his own. It's a far greater error to overtry a case when you're a prosecutor than a defense attorney because of the burden of proof. Stewart was able to hammer home the concept that not a single person had testified to being instructed to lock the door. Stewart's emphasis was correctly placed in his summation. I think had Bostwick cut down some of his self-damaging witnesses and played up the fire department's report of the situation as they entered the ninth floor, along with the concept of habit, we would have been looking at two convictions. Prosecutors are required to prove each element of each crime beyond a reasonable doubt. Stewart was able to identify the particular elements which were weakest and exploit them to bring down the prosecution's house of cards. So that's the show for this installment. Special thank you to Dan Townsend for livening up the show and keeping things interesting from an audio perspective. Special thank you also to Philip de Cassan over in the United Kingdom, who has been extolling the virtues of the show over there. I really appreciate it. And thank you also to everyone who consistently reaches out with thoughts and feedback. It really means a lot to me that you listen and think about these issues and how they could apply to other cases as well. If you enjoyed discussing the Triangle Shirtwaist Company manslaughter case and want to hear about some other famous trials, please listen to the previous shows and subscribe to the podcast so that you'll automatically get episodes delivered to you every other week when they're published. If you want to reach me, you can email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod, or you can look me up on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. Please keep the comments rolling. Thanks for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.